Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We begin our program with a study from Southern Medical Institute, and it's about quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. And why is it important? Because it was found to have natural protection against the influenza or flu virus. Now, we're in flu season now, when weather changes, people's immune system is not always up, as it frequently is in the summer, because you're out, you're eating more fruits and vegetables, drinking juices, you're getting more sunlight, all important and all good. So what do we do? Well, you can take a vaccine for flu, that's fine, but please do your homework first. Look up all the scientific studies on which neurotoxins are in the flu vaccine, if they're in there, and how safe and effective is it. And another way you could approach the flu season is by building up your immune system. And one of the strongest antivirals you can take in is the potent flavonoid and phytonutrient-rich foods such as berries and apples, quercetins and apples, onions, lots of quercetin and onion, especially the sweet raw onion. So what these scientists did, they released a study showing that quercetin can actually block the flu virus from entering cells, which the virus needs in order to live and replicate and do damage. The team conducted this study by adding quercetin to cells prior to infecting them with influenza and found that quercetin-treated cells had significantly lower rates of infection than the cells that had not been treated, an obvious inhibitory effect. Quercetin was found to be effective against influenza A, as well as its subtypes, H1N1 and H3N1. It was also found to work against H5N1 or avian flu, a particularly dangerous subtype with a 60% death rate. Researchers characterized quercetin as having the potential to be a safe, effective, and affordable treatment for influenza A viruses. By the way, viruses survive by cellular invasion in which they penetrate the host cell membrane. To do this, they use two viral proteins known as H and N, and scientists have been studying the way viruses attack cells for years and are now looking into natural strategies of blocking the process. The team noted that quercetin blocked H protein along with it virus entry, and this finding showed that quercetin was effective when added during the process of viral infection rather than post-virus infection. In other words, quercetin stopped the influenza virus in its tracks near the beginning of the infection process, which consists of attachment, entry, replication, and release. Also encouraging is the fact that viruses are not able to develop resistance to quercetin. In fact, when quercetin was used with antiviral drugs, it prevented the development of resistance that otherwise would occur. This is an immune benefit, an innate immune benefit, as for years, scientists have been concerned about viruses' ability to mutate and become resistant to antiviral drugs. Now, from my own clinical experience, I have found that when adding quercetin at, let's say, 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams in divided doses over a period of about 6 hours, and then using L-lysine at the same potency and vitamin C at the same potency altogether. And then you can also, and this you can do preventatively, and this keeps your entire immune system strong, and it attacks all kinds of viruses, including herpes virus. And by the way, contrary to what you might have believed, you can reverse herpes. And in fact, the hardest herpes to reverse is herpes 6, and it's the most deadly. And repeatedly, we've been able to reverse herpes 6. We did it at the Institute of Biology, and I did it for 10 years prior to the Institute of Biology, and in people who were suffering from herpes 6 infections, pre-HIV discovery in 1984. So just saying, there's a lot we can do to keep our body healthy. Now, from Michigan State University comes a study about heavy metals. That's lead, mercury, cadmium, etc. And it's in our food. And it's most dangerous for children. The problem of foodborne metal contamination has taken on new urgency, thanks in part to a 2021 U.S. congressional report detailing high levels of metals found in infant food pulled off grocery shelves. Now, two new studies provide information on the correlation between exposure to heavy metals in food and the risk of cancers and other serious health effects. Mind you, again, when you use aluminum foil and you put something, wrap it up, and you put it into the oven, or you wrap a baked potato, something is common in the South, you wrap a baked potato in aluminum foil and you put it in the oven, well, you're getting lead, you're getting aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, you can get any number of common foods from rice and cereals to nuts and spinach that we cook in, and even the water that you boil something, if it's aluminum, it's going to leach out particles of aluminum and get into the food. So try to use no aluminum, and don't use aluminum deodorants, and just be conscious of the quality of the food, especially get organic, especially for children, because food crops can absorb heavy metals from contaminated soil, air, and water. So it's not just the food itself, it's where was it grown, and what was the air quality and the soil quality. To become a certified organic farmer, which I am, they came out and they inspect your soil. They take soil samples and water samples. Which water are you using? If you're using groundwater, okay, or if you have an aquifer, all right, they test it. And sometimes people are shocked to find how many heavy metals are in their so-called spring water. Yeah. And then they look at what do you spray on your plants to keep aphids off and beetles, etc. And I show them all this, the garlic oil, and this is the cayenne. And then I show them the natural, non-toxic elements I put together and spray to kill the insects. And then interplanting, nasturtiums and shallots and garlic you plant around your leafy vegetables. And they act as a natural pesticide. In any case, after they spend the whole day and they do all these tests, then they either say you're not ready yet or they certify you. And so when I buy produce as well as growing it, I make sure it's all organic, wherever possible. Now, there'll be circumstances where it's not possible. And then the ones that I wouldn't use, if they're not organic, I don't buy. And the ones that, like avocados and nuts, tree nuts, you don't have to have them organic because, A, most of the time they're not sprayed, and B, they have a protective shell. So not everything has to be certified organic. In any case, just remember, if you're feeding a kid as well as yourself, look at cadmium. It's a toxic metal found in nuts and potatoes and seeds and cereal grains, leafy vegetables, and among its sources in the environment are fertilizers and industrial emissions. So check your soil, or if you're buying from a farmer's market, ask them to do the same, because that can lead to increased risk of prostate, renal, bladder, breast, and pancreatic and endometrial cancers. It also showed moderate to high scores for non-cancer risk like renal, developmental, reproductive, immunological, and neurological effects. So it makes a big difference, the quality of the food you buy. Now, University of California, San Francisco has a study about wandering minds. Well, everyone's mind wanders at different points in the day, but it's associated with aging cells. Scientific studies have succeeded in understanding what happens when the mind wanders. It generally indicates unhappiness, Whereas a mind that is present, focused, disciplined, in that moment, generally indicates well-being. Now, a preliminary University of California San Francisco study suggests a possible link between mind wandering and aging by looking at a biological measure of longevity. In the study, telomere length, remember I've talked about this many times, the longer the telomeres, and that's the end caps of your chromosomes, the longer that chromosome will last. Alcohol, drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, diets, high-protein diets, cooked foods, acrylamides from baked goods, all of these shorten your telomeres and hence shorten the lifespan of the and in effect, it's almost like it unwinds, it frays, and then the chromosome is susceptible to oxidative stress, and it shortens and dies. Lack of exercise, stress, cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines, they also can shorten it. So if you stay chronically stressed or acutely stressed, you're shortening your telomeres. That in turn is a marker for the cellular and general bodily aging. So by assessing the association between the current, let's say, your mindset and your telomeres, the people who are happiest had the longest telomeres. So there's an enzyme called telomerase, and a healthy diet, exercising, good supplementations, carnosine and L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10, NAD and PQQ and resveratrol and pycnogenol. These are all, and quercetin, these are all your anti-aging nutrients that strengthen the resistance of that DNA becoming susceptible. So just saying, so your state of mind absolutely unequivocally impacts stress, which then impacts your death when you're going to have it. So mindful meditation interventions, calmness, listening to soothing music, being in a wonderful environment like nature, being focused, that promotes attention on the present with compassionate attitude of acceptance and leads to an increase in some aspects of health. And so just a suggestion, something to help us all. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come back. And by the way, tomorrow, finally, after decades, Harvard University has found that mainstream medicine should embrace the placebo effect because it's, quote, real medicine, end quote. It's not snake oil. It's real. And I'll go into that because a lot of the work I've done in anti-aging has shown that what we thought was a placebo was actually the body. So they never gave any credit to the body's own intelligence. Well, now they've woken late, like 100 years late, but okay, so what? We're going to be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'm about to play you a clip, and every day this week I'm going to play a primary clip around which other clips will be supporting the same issue. And why am I doing this? Because people say, well, Gary, I just want to know about sunflower seeds or how much vitamin C is in an orange, and that's fine. And that's why I do a whole segment on brand new every day. I mean, where else are you getting brand new information from mainstream medicine peer-reviewed that supports natural and complementary approaches to preventing and helping with disease? But then The big question is, are you aware that there are sources out there trying to prevent you from living a natural life, having the capacity for critical thought, that are taking away your rights, even if you say, well, it's not important. I don't have anything to hide, so if they want to put a camera in my toilet, my bathroom, you know, my bedroom, I don't care. That's fine, because everyone out there seems to want to know more about you and everything possible so they can control you. Think not. Wait till you see all the clips this week. But how does this happen? How do you take people, and I've known this, you've heard me repeatedly on this program and in my lectures, say this. The easiest people to manipulate their awareness are the most educated. And the ones least likely to change, least likely to follow healthy protocols, are the most educated. The ones most likely to say, yeah, I'll try it, you know, what I got to lose, now I'm terminal, are just the average working class people. And the ones that succeed are those same people. Now, I won't go into all the reasons why. I'm going to be doing that in our classroom on the air later today. But now, a professor, Matthias Desmet, who wrote the book on the psychology of totalitarianism and the whole idea of mass psychosis, and who are the people most likely to become victims and perpetrators of mass psychosis? The most powerful. So that's not good. And but I want you to hear how so many different individuals out there, the heads of government, the heads of corporations, the people that we generally think are the best and brightest, how those individuals who directed the COVID operation, which is a total failure and a scam from beginning to end, and we've challenged every single thing they've said. We were right, they were wrong. So why don't all them say, you know something, you were right, we were wrong, let's apologize and go forward and learn a lesson. So why don't we change? And why doesn't the professional class change? Why, if they see that their models of behavior are wrong, why don't they change the model? Why doesn't the entire cancer industry change its model of prevention and treatment? But it won't. Now, again, I want you to hear what he has to say. Because look at all of the problems we suffer from today, all the different issues of global warming and unnecessary wars and regime changes and the population de-aging, dying younger, and more obesity, more diabetes in our children, and the abuses that we're seeing, the refusal to obey the laws, apologizing to criminals, and yet the victims we have no sympathy for. I mean, everything that's going on, there's an underlying core reason why. Smart people do stupid things, and good people do bad things. And that's because they're not smart and they're not good when they're doing it. How did they get that, and why don't they learn from it? Why don't they change? Because in my experience, and I've told you this repeatedly, and I have a long history of working with people and groups, the people least likely to succeed are celebrities, people who feel entitled, people who have grown up in bubbles, people who are successful, because, well, I'll go through why, my opinion. I want you to hear him. And I want to thank The High Wire and Dell Bigtree. I first met Dell about 7 years ago when I got a call and he was doing a demonstration over, and he was filming a documentary over at New York University Langone Center. And he didn't have many people there. It was a cold winter day. So I asked my audience, would you join me over there? And about 300 to 400 people joined me an hour later. And he's a nice guy. And he really deserves credit because he is a very important forum. He does good work. I think he's very ethical. And he has a whole library. And you might want to pursue his library to see all the other people who are out there doing good work who have no forum to go on except his and a few others. Here's the clip. And this is the core of our program today.
This is a guest that I have been so excited to have the opportunity to speak with for a very long time. We talked about mass formation psychosis before. We talked to Dr. Mark McDonald. But Matthias Desmet is behind the mass formation discussion out of Belgium. He has written The Psychology of Totalitarianism, which comes out today, actually. So it is my honor and privilege to have him coming up for a sense of what we're talking about. Here is what it's looked like in your news.
Well, the term mass formation psychosis trended over the weekend with so many searches it broke the internet. When people went to search for the term on Google, a couple of strange things happened. Some people saw this odd disclaimer from Google saying the results were changing quickly and that it would take time for results to be added by reliable sources. What does this even mean? I thought when you Googled something, it would bring up sites relating to the topic. Sounds like they're censoring search results. Well, a few hours later, when people searched for the term, a bunch of sites began to pop up claiming it was a new far-right buzzword or one attributed to anti-vaxxers. So what is mass formation psychosis? Well, the term came recently from the Joe Rogan Dr. Robert Malone interview that aired this past Friday.
And this leads into this whole issue of mass formation psychosis. There's good modeling studies that probably 500,000 excess deaths have happened in the United States through the intentional blockade of early treatment by the U.S. government.
But was also heard and explained in more detail during Dr. Peter McCullough's interview with Rogan.
We're in what's called a mass formation psychosis. This is very important. I give credit to Dr. Matthias Desmet in the University of Ghent in Belgium. Mass psychosis is when there is a groupthink that develops that's so strong that it leads to something horrific.
If all the people who want to speak out against the mainstream narrative, if they would unify and become one group, they would be powerful enough to change the direction of the middle group. We should continue to speak out.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing we can do.
For any of you out there in the world that have been saying, I feel like I'm walking around an insane asylum, or, you know what I mean, the lunatics have taken over the insane asylum, I'm there with you. Matthias Desmet has done some incredible work on the concept of mass formation. It is my honor and privilege to be joined by him now. So to begin with, there's been some confusion in the term. I don't want to get buried here, mass formation psychosis, but you just call it mass formation. Is that correct?
Yes, I prefer to call it mass formation. Yes, I never use the term mass formation psychosis because in my opinion, both from an ethical and from an intellectual point of view, it's better to use the term mass formation.
Okay. Now, you know, one of my questions is mass formation in a term you've come up with, or is this an older term in psychology? That's something I haven't understood yet. Has this been around for some time?
The term was used from the 19th century onwards by such authors as Gustave Le Bon. Freud also used it one time. Elias Canetti used it. So it was definitely used before I used it, but maybe not in such a systematic way. That's possible.
Okay. Now, for my audience out there, I know you've told this story many, many times. But there's so many people that still have not really heard, you know, what mass formation is and how it comes about. Obviously, we're talking about this pandemic in many ways, which is why we're having this conversation. But take me through, what are the elements, you know, is there a state that a population, obviously, this isn't always the world. It can be a continent. It can be, you know, a smaller group of people. But there has to be a set of things taking place, of like a climate that makes us vulnerable to this. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mass formation is a specific kind of group formation, which has very specific effects at the level of individual mental functioning. For instance, it tends to make people completely incapable of taking a critical distance of what the group believes in. And in the end, the group starts to believe in the most absurd things, such as, to give one concrete example, during the revolution in Iran, the revolution of 1979, which was the beginning of a large-scale process of mass formation in Iran, people started to believe that the portrait, the picture of the Ayatollah, the leader of the mass, you could say, was printed on the surface of the moon. And when there was a full moon in the sky, people typically stood out in the streets pointing at the moon, showing where exactly they could see the portrait of the Ayatollah. That's one historical example of how absurd the beliefs of a mass can come. So that's one typical characteristic of the phenomenon of mass formation, one typical effect of mass formation on individual mental functioning, but there is more. For instance, people who are in the grip of a mass formation typically become willing to self-sacrifice. It is as if they are no longer aware of their own personal egoistic interests. And this goes very far as well. People become radically aware to sacrifice everything that was important to them before the mass formation started. And a third characteristic that is extremely important is that people who are in the grip of mass formation typically become radically intolerant for dissonant voices. And in the end, they tend to stigmatize the people that do not go along with them, give them a sign, and then start to commit cruelties towards them, and in the end, try to eliminate or destroy them. And even more important or more characteristic, they do so as if it is an ethical duty to do that, to destroy these other people. And they even become radically aggressive and intolerant towards the people they used to love very much before the mass formation. I will give a concrete example again. 2 months ago, I was talking to this woman of Iran, Shoreh Fishtali. This conversation is available on the internet, who lived in Iran during the revolution. And she has seen with her own eyes how a mother reported her son to the state and hung the rope around his neck just before he was hung, and how she claimed to be a heroine for doing so. That's one concrete example, but it's typical for all mass formations, whether we are talking about the Crusades or about the witch hunts or about the French Revolution or about the rise of the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, all typical examples, historical examples of mass formation. Every time we see this very typical characteristic that in the end, people start to commit cruelties to everyone, even the people they loved very much before the mass formation, and they do so as if it is an ethical duty to do so. That's the last stage of mass formation. And it is extremely important to understand the mechanism, the psychological mechanism of mass formation. Because if you understand it, you know what we have to do to avoid the process of mass formation going to this ultimate, terrible stage. And that's, well, of course, I've been explaining this mechanism of mass formation. It's indeed, as you already suggested, the population has to be in a specific psychological state.
Yeah, tell me about that. Tell me about, like, what makes us vulnerable as a society, you know, to this type. And you're talking about, this transcends education levels, right? You're talking about essentially, you know, the majority of humanity are vulnerable to being to taking part in this. I mean, I used to always argue with my friends growing up that anybody could be a Nazi if you were in the right circumstances and socialized correctly. I think for the most part, most of us, it's very rare that we have some sort of moral code or super critical thinking that breaks us apart from it. But before we get into like what makes it, what makes us vulnerable to this type of movement?
Yes. Well, first and for all, some people are resilient. Some people do not fall prey to mass formation, but it's very hard to know why and which people do not fall prey to it. But as you said, intelligence doesn't protect you from mass formation, not at all. And the level of education is even a counterindication. The higher the level of education, the more vulnerable for mass formation. That has been observed in the 19th century and 20th century, and we see it again now. So, but indeed, the most important thing is that, well, a population has to be in a very specific mental state in order for large-scale mass formation to emerge. And the most crucial condition for large-scale mass formation is that many people have to be disconnected from their natural and their social environment. So many people have to feel lonely, have to feel atomized, as Hannah Arendt called it. And what you could see, for instance, was that just before the corona crisis, the number of lonely people really peaked in Western society and even worldwide. Over 30% of the people worldwide reported in a Gallup World Poll that they didn't have one meaningful relationship and that they only connected to others through the internet.
Yeah.
That gives you an idea of the extent of the problem. In the UK, Theresa May appointed a minister of loneliness. And in the US, the US Surgeon General concluded that there was a loneliness epidemic. That was around 2017, and the problem only became worse since then. So that's the most crucial condition, is this social isolation of a substantial part of the population. And then the second condition actually follows from the first one. Once people feel disconnected, they will typically start to be confronted with a lack of purpose and meaning in life. And that's just because human beings are social beings, and they have the feeling that their life makes sense if they see that they have an effect on the other. So if their relationship with the other impoverishes, if there is no strong social bond anymore, people will typically start to suffer or to be confronted with lack of meaning making in life. So that's the second condition, and also that condition was really fulfilled just before the corona crisis. Over 60% of the people worldwide claimed that they considered their own job to be a bullshit job. That means a job which they couldn't think of, for whom it might mean something.
Right.
or to what it could. So that were extremely high figures. Only 15% of the people worldwide consider their own job to be meaningful.
Wow. So they're living, they're feeling lonely. They're living what they consider to be a meaningless life. And so those are two of the conditions, right? What else is...
Exactly. And the third condition, the third and the fourth condition are also crucial. The third condition is that when people are in this state of disconnectedness and lack of meaning making, they will typically be confronted with so-called freely floating anxiety, frustration and aggression. That means that a kind of anxiety, a kind of frustration and aggression that is not connected to a mental representation, or to put it in plain terms, a kind of anxiety in which people don't know what they feel anxious for, a kind of frustration and aggression in which people don't know what they feel frustrated and aggressive for. And this is an extremely aversive mental state, because if you feel anxious and you don't know what you feel anxious for, you feel completely out of control. You feel as if you cannot control your anxiety just because you don't know what you're anxious for. And under these conditions, if these conditions are fulfilled in a population, something very typical might happen. If under these conditions, a narrative is distributed through the mass media, indicating an object of anxiety, and at the same time, providing a strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, then all this free-floating anxiety in society might connect to the object of anxiety, provided a narrative, and there might be a huge willingness to participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety. The reason why is clear. If people can connect their anxiety to an object and participate in a strategy to deal with this object, they feel in control again. And it doesn't matter then whether this object of anxiety is the true object of their anxiety or not. That is the first step of every major phenomenon of mass formation. In the Crusades, the object of anxiety was the Muslims. In the witch hunts, the object of anxiety was the witches. And during the French Revolution, it was the Ancien Régime. In the Soviet Union, it was the aristocracy. In the Nazi Germany, it was the Jews. And now, in the Corona crisis, it was the coronavirus and all the people that refused to go along with the battle to fight the coronavirus.
Right.
So, it's the first step of mass formation is always the coupling, the connection of the free-floating anxiety to one object, which makes that people become very focused. All the attention is directed at one very small aspect of reality from then on, and the rest of reality disappears into darkness. And the second step is even more important, because so many people at the same time participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, people have the feeling that they are connected again. They don't feel lonely anymore. They fight a collective heroic battle with an enemy, feel connected again. And we could say, okay, and what's the problem then? People felt lonely, now they feel connected again.
Right.
Well, there is a huge problem, because this new connection, this new group, this mass that emerges in a society is not formed because individuals connect to each other. It's formed because every individual separately connects to the collective. That means that in a mass, people are typically very enthusiastic and full of solidarity. But the solidarity is not a solidarity with other individuals. It's a solidarity between an individual and the collective. And even the longer the mass formation lasts, the more all the psychological energy, all the love and solidarity is sucked away from the bonds between individuals and all injected and invested in the bond between the individual and the collective. And that explains, of course, why in the end, people show a radical lack of solidarity with each other and a huge solidarity with the collective. And as a consequence, they are willing to report everyone, even their loved ones, to the collective.
Wow.
And that's, yes, that's typically what happened during the corona crisis. We were all full of most people were full of solidarity. Yeah. And at the same time, they accepted that when someone got an accident on the street, they were no longer allowed to help that person. It was stipulated right. Like that on the websites of the Dutch, the Holland government, the European government, and probably also on the website of the US government. And in the same vein, people accepted that if their parents were dying, if their father or mother was dying, they were no longer allowed to visit them anymore. That was the kind of solidarity that emerged in the corona crisis and that emerges in every mass formation and in every totalitarian state, which is usually a consequence of mass, always a consequence of mass formation. That's what I describe in my book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. The consequence of mass formation is that in the end, people end up in a radically paranoid atmosphere.
I'd like your thoughts. You can call us later in the show at 888-874-4888 if you'd like to share your input. But to show you how powerful this is and how this whole psychosis that people buy into is like a cult. It doesn't just happen overnight, but when you get the same message repeatedly, well, we're in a crisis right now, financial crisis, and after 9/11, and the President of the United States says, go out and buy stuff, shop. And so people think, okay, but what if you hear that constantly, shop? What if you don't have the money? Well, use credit cards. What if your credit cards are maxed out? Well, then come up with some way to create more debt. No one's ever saying, this is really stupid. Glenn Greenwald is taking on the entire American media. And listen to what Desmet just said and see how this ties into why you're lied to every single day by the mainstream media. All of them. Now, these are not people who don't have resources to find the truth, or they're not intellectually capable of understanding it. They are. These are highly educated people. But once again, they're programmable. And we forget that some of the most easily programmed people are the people who benefit from the programming. And so listen to what he has to say. Very important clip.
Well, media doesn't really cover this story because it requires the use of technical terms like Section 702 and FISA, that I know kind of by design make people sort of turn away. It seems very like technocratic, it seems very distant, it seems very technical, the kinds of issues that you're discussing. But also corporate media in general will not cover issues unless the two parties are at each other's throats over them. When the two parties join and unite, as they have here and as they do on so many issues like it, corporate media just think it's not worth covering it, in part because the model of corporate media is to polarize along party lines. So you have media outlets that are more Republican and media outlets that are more Democrat, and that's how the audience wants to understand the world. And if you can't feed them a narrative that valorizes one party and villainizes the other, as can't be done on this issue and so many others because the parties are joined at the hip and have the same view, it's just not a value or worth. They assume their audience will turn away. But also this requires pointing out the abuses of the U.S. security state, and that is one thing the corporate media won't do. So this is not a technical issue. This is about your core fundamental rights of privacy, the question of whether the U.S. government will be able to spy not on other countries and foreign populations, but on our own citizens without the warrants that are so foundational to the entire American founding. One of the main reasons the colonists and the founders in the United States rebelled against the British king was because of this unlimited spying. They would just send the king's police and guards into people's homes at will, no warrants, no demonstration of guilt, look through their papers, look through their private affairs, and the Fourth Amendment was crucially designed to prevent it. And we now have somehow a spying apparatus on the part of the very agencies that have proven over and over that they will abuse their power for political ends, beginning with the FBI, that have somehow been given the power, primarily after 9/11, in the name of fear of terrorism, that allows them to spy on the phone calls and email communications and other digital conversations of American citizens without first going to a court and obtaining warrants. And the risk of abuse is not theoretical. Every 4 years, there's an Inspector General's report that documents the extensive abuse on the part of the FBI. And we showed you when we interviewed Senator Lee, the exchange that he had with the FBI director, Christopher Wray, over exactly this issue. Every time the FBI goes to Congress and says, we're all going to die unless you keep giving us this power, members of Congress say, but what about all the times you've abused it? The FBI always says, oh, don't worry, we've reformed ourselves. We've implemented new rules that will never happen again. I've been hearing the same thing since the very beginning of the war on terror when these programs were first installed, and in 2005 when they were first exposed. And it's just, it's the same exact Groundhog Day over and over and over. And that's why when Senator Lee and Congressman Massey, who deserve a lot of credit, they took the lead in trying to stop this, were telling me that they were optimistic about the prospect for finally stopping this because there was bipartisan movement to impose reforms. I wanted to believe them, but as I said to you and to them, I was so skeptical. And now here we have many media outlets. Let's just pick The Hill today. Congress approves short-term extension of warrantless surveillance powers. Quote, included in the defense policy bill headed to the president's desk after approval by the House on Thursday is a measure that extends Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, until mid-April. Several conservative lawmakers voiced frustration over its inclusion in a must-pass bill. Quote, the fact of the matter is what's being stated is it is impossible to oppose the National Defense Authorization Act because we put a pay raise in it or because we put something in there that is seemingly so important that we have to ignore the critical destruction of our civil liberties by adding FISA extension right on top of it without doing the form necessary to protect the American people, said Congressman Chip Roy, a Republican of Texas, who has argued a FISA authorization reauthorization should be a standalone bill. Now, let me just explain the procedure because sometimes congressional procedure can be complicated, but it's important to understand so that when we look at the roll call votes, you can see who in Congress is responsible, and some of the names might surprise you. What happened was there's a National Defense Authorization Act that gets passed every year. It's basically the military budget for the next year, and you have to pass it, otherwise the military won't be funded. And so a lot of members of Congress try to jam as many controversial things in there that they can so that it doesn't get a standalone vote. It just becomes part of this military budget that everybody has to vote for, no matter what's in it. And what they tried to do and succeeded in doing was taking this extension of the FBI's warrantless eavesdropping powers, knowing it was controversial, and they just jammed it into this overall defense budget that they knew people were going to have to vote for. And in the Senate, there was an effort by Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, the Republican senator from Kentucky, to remove this provision. And the new speaker, Mike Johnson, had promised there'd be a standalone vote, that it wouldn't just be thrown into some overall legislation. And what happened was in the Senate, the motion or by Rand Paul to remove it failed by a vote of 65 against 35 in favor. Rand Paul only needed 41 votes to remove the warrantless eavesdropping renewal, and it failed by 6 votes. He had a bipartisan coalition with him voting to remove it, but the majority of the Senate, the majority of Democrats, the majority of Republicans in the Senate voted to keep it in. And then Mike Johnson for whatever reason, didn't make good on his promise to remove it and have a standalone vote. He kept it in the overall budget. And then a lot of people, as Chip Roy was just complaining, felt they had to vote for it, even though it had this unconstitutional provision that is extremely dangerous. There were some people who voted no anyway on the overall budget. I'm not sure if Chip Roy was one of them. We'll show you the roll call vote, but that's the way that it happened. They didn't really have a vote on the renewal itself, except in the Senate. And we do have that roll call vote, which we're going to show you, of who is responsible for keeping it in the overall budget. Now, to understand why this is so dangerous, we explained it and went through the history of it with the show that we did with Senator Lee, the other show we did with Congressman Massey. So if you want to really hear the detailed explanation of how this came to be, how it is that the FBI has the power to spy on American citizens without warrants, please go watch those segments, which we took out from the overall show and published as standalone segments. But here's Jamil Jaffer, who for many years was at the ACLU. He was one of my favorite ACLU lawyers. He had nothing to do with the ACLU's partisanship or focus on left liberal cultural issues. He didn't work on trans issues. He wasn't there to turn the ACLU into an arm of the Democratic Party. He was a civil libertarian. He is a civil libertarian. And he probably knows more about the history of warrantless eavesdropping in FISA than almost anyone in the country. He now works at the Knight Center at Columbia for the First Amendment. He's also a major free speech advocate. And he had this thread on Twitter explaining why this is so dangerous to you, to all Americans. And Edward Snowden recommended it. And I just want to share the first several tweets, even though it was a pretty long thread, just to give you a sense. Jamil is a very rhetorically constrained person. He doesn't use melodramatic language. He doesn't use hyperbole in any way. He's a very careful lawyer. And I found it just so notable that he felt compelled to explain how dangerous this bill is, how dangerous these powers are. Here's what he wrote, quote, "I don't think Americans understand the extent to which the, quote, foreign intelligence exception has hollowed out the Fourth Amendment." Now, what he means by that is that under the Fourth Amendment, as part of a criminal investigation, if the government wants to spy on your communications, it has to go get a warrant first. And what they say is, oh, but when we're not doing a criminal investigation, when we're just gathering foreign intelligence, our powers increase. That's what 9/11 ushered in. All the fears of 9/11 gave the government greater powers with the Patriot Act and things like that. So that when they're claiming that they're not conducting a law enforcement investigation, but a intelligence gathering operation, they have greater powers to censor. And they used to call that the intelligence exception to the warrant requirement. Oh, just in the cases where we're collecting foreign intelligence, that's the exception to the Fourth Amendment. And here's he's now explaining why this exception has turned into the rule and completely destroyed the Fourth Amendment. He goes on, quote, "Most reporting about the current legislative debate is technical and incremental and misses the forest for the trees. Here's what's crucial. What was once an extremely narrow exception to ordinary constitutional principles has become, over time, a justification for warrantless surveillance on a staggering scale, not just of foreigners' communications, but of Americans' communications too. With respect to Americans' international communications, the Fourth Amendment has become essentially a dead letter. Intelligence officials have obscured this quite intentionally over the course of multiple administrations, both Democratic and Republican. But since the Snowden disclosures, the line has been that Americans don't need to worry about the surveillance because the NSA activities are targeted at foreigners abroad. And any collection of Americans' communication is incidental or inadvertent. But every part of this sentence is misleading because intel officials have accorded unusual definitions to all of the important words in it." In other words, what they're doing is they're saying that, oh, don't worry, when we are spying without warrants, we're only targeting foreign nationals. Now, we will read your emails and listen to your phone calls without warrants, but only if you happen to be talking to the foreign targets that we're spying on. And then we just incidentally or accidentally end up spying on your conversations too with no warrants. But as Jamil is explaining, they played with this, these words so much that They can easily spy on your conversations if they want by targeting not foreign nationals, but you. And that's why it's not rare that they do it. It's very common. It's by the tens of thousands that they're reading emails and listening to Americans' conversations without the warrants required by law. And there are abuses of it for totally improper ends, for political ends, is extremely well documented. And that's what makes it so dangerous. Now, here is the House vote, as I explained. This is the actual vote on whether to, on the National Defense Authorization Act itself, and on a motion to agree to the conference report. And the breakdown there is, as you can see, it's very bipartisan. You have 147 Republicans voting to pass it, and 163 Democrats. So the overwhelming majority of both parties voted yes. You had 310 yes votes. You had 73 Republicans voting no, 45 Democrats voting no, and so you had 118 voted no. And so it passed by this gigantic majority.
Okay. What's important he misses, in my opinion. I appreciate much of the work that Glenn does, but look at where he's gone. He's shown us the problem, but not the solution. Let me give you a different overview. Almost all of Congress, there are some exceptions, but very few, have been controlled for their entire career by the lobbyist. Foundations, think tanks, and mostly corporate America gives over $2 billion a year to people to go in and influence voting. And so what was not discussed? Not the FISA search warrants, because Obama was found to have allowed a major telephone communication company to be storing billions of messages, meaning they've been spying on us, listening to all of our phone calls, emails for a long time. Then before Congress came, the head of the National Security Agency, Clapper, and he was asked, do you do this? And he said, no, he lied. And it's demonstrably true, he lied. Nothing was ever done to him. Once again, a two-tier system of justice. You lie before Congress, if you're on the side that benefits from the lie and is in power, nothing happens to you. Then Comey lies. Comey lies because the very FISA warrant that they're talking about here was falsified on three separate occasions. That's a felony. Now, what you should have heard is you should have heard of the FISA judges complaining and demanding immediate accountability to those people at the FBI, including Comer, who lied about the need for these FISA warrants. Because what were those FISA warrants? They weren't the FISA warrants that they lied about and got falsely approved by FISA. Those were about the Clinton dossier and trying to see if Clinton or any of his allies were complicit with Russia in causing the election to go to Trump instead of to Hillary Clinton. But again, the FBI already knew from top administrators and the Justice Department knew that Trump had nothing to do with it. But in Congress, a legislator from California, Southern California, and that should surprise no one that they would vote for this guy, Adam Schiff. He was the head of the committee, and every day you saw him on television harking at the fact that this was, you know, a fixed election and Russia was involved and Trump was involved. So they went after all the people around Trump. And indeed, they, General Flynn, the FBI got him and sentenced him to jail. He had to plead guilty to one charge. Otherwise, they would have gone after his son. So that's just one example. Paul Manafort and others, they actually put in jail. And they did not commit a crime. And then you had, with colluding with Russia, there were four investigations, four different investigations, because the Democrats kept saying, and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, there's got to be evidence here that he colluded. There was no evidence. None. I played you that clip the other day where the head of that investigation, the largest, longest, and most comprehensive, said there was no collusion whatsoever at any point with any of these people. It was all made up. It was a lie. The dossier was a lie. the Russian agent who participated, the FBI decided not to interview, but gave him money, $100,000, over $200,000. That was a lie. Everything he said was a lie. The Clintons lied. Everyone lied. And yet not a single person was held accountable. That should show you something about what this larger message is. So how do they get away with these crimes against humanity? When Obama said that Gaddafi represented a threat to the world and was killing his own people, the CIA was involved in setting that up with infiltrators. None of Gaddafi's forces were killing their own people. That was a lie. Seymour Hersh and others proved that there was no poison gas in Syria given by Assad. That was a lie. How about the CIA and the other agencies that said, oh, he's gassing his own, that allows us to go in there, and we're still there. And Syria was the breadbasket of all the Middle East. It grew more food than any other country in the Middle East. But now there was a war caused by the United States. And why? Because they have rich oil, crude oil there. But that's in one part of the country that the Kurds and Turkey were fighting over, and the United States goes in and just conquers it all. And every day, 24 hours a day, we're stealing a sovereign country's oil, which meant that there was no money to buy food for the starving Syrian people. So they've been decimated by ISIS. We created ISIS, don't forget that. We created al-Nusra, we created al-Qaeda, we created Mujahideen that fought the Russians. Without thinking, what are the consequences when we arm terrorists? Well, now we see the consequences in Afghanistan. So everything we've done has been a lie. We haven't done one single thing right in the world. We're impossible to do it. Hard to imagine. Now I played that clip to show you how you can control the mindset of an entire group of people. Think of all the people that didn't question the vaccine, roll up their arm. Well, I got a little surprise for you. I'm not going to blame you. I'm not going to do what the Jimmy Kimmel and Howard Stern, the other dancing clowns in the media do, because we're serious here. We do our homework, real scholarship. Every single thing that Fauci and them said was a lie. But here's what you didn't know until right now, unless you could read and speak Japanese and go to two of the most respected scientific institutions in the world in Japan and look at Professor Tanaka Atsushi and a Professor Takayuki, quote, unnatural evolutionary processes of SARS-2 variants and possibility of deliberate natural selection. Quote, you haven't heard this. This should be a front page story in the New York Times, but you won't see this New York Times at all because they're part of the problem. They also suffer in their readers and their editors and their publishers from the same form of cult-like psychoses. Quote, over the past 3 years, severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 has repeatedly caused pandemics, generating various mutated variants ranging from Alpha to Omicron. In this study, we aim to clarify the evolutionary processes leading to the formation of SARS-2 Omicron variants, focusing on Omicron variants with many amino acid mutations in the spike protein variants. We compared the sequences of 129 Omicron BA1 related, 141 BA1.1 related, and 122 BA2 related isolates, and attempted to clarify the evolutionary process of SARS-2 Omicron variants. It's a little technical, but here's what they found, and this is what's so important. And this was published in a major peer-reviewed journal, and they're from very respected institutions. The bottom line is that they're stating here that all 100% of the variants that we're told we got to get your vaccines because of the variants, all those were biologically manipulated and made by human beings. Quote, Japanese scientists find indisputable evidence that all COVID variants are man-made. Quote, a stunning Japanese study that has evolved from reprint to peer review publication suggests that all COVID-19 variants were engineered in biolabs and intentionally released upon humanity. First released in August 2023, this study conducted by renowned Japanese virologist professors Atsushi Tanaka and Takayuki Miyazawa of Osaka Medical University and Kyoto University affirms the push to keep COVID around in part of a nefarious deep state scheme to remove our individual freedoms and control us. As their work progressed, they discovered roughly 100 separate Omicron subvariants that could not possibly have arisen naturally. Oh, wow. So that means that there are parties, yet unknown, that were getting money, that we know. Rand Paul questioned, and you can see that the person who's head of the agency wouldn't say whether or not these biolabs around the world, which we now know, but why isn't nobody like Klingerol says, why do we accept the National Defense Authorization Act, which funds all this, biolabs, the Army, when we know how corrupt they are? Got to say goodbye to WBI, but we're going to continue. I'm going to do more on this, but this just shows you that an entire political party, both the Republican and Democrat, the entire medical establishment, the entire scientific establishment, with few exceptions, are going to go along with what the programming details because A, it benefits their career, B, they develop a mindset when they've heard a lie long enough, they believe it, and then they believe that they're being heroic by fighting those who actually hold the truth. They hold the lie. Have you seen anyone? Have you seen Howard Stern and anyone else? Even Howard Stern's audience say, Howard, on this one, buddy, you got it wrong. We love you for everything else you do because we're all about 10th grade and we love your humor, this adolescent humor. But fine, you have a right to that. We have a right to listen to it. But on this, you're wrong. And how many people in his audience would say, and because you demanded it, I went out and got my vaccines and then I got my boosters. Oh, and by the way, I now suffer from this. My wife died of that. My child died of that. Not a word of apology. That's what we're talking about. When you can do anything to a public, now it's going to be we're taking away their currency, giving a digital currency so they control every purchase. Then they're going to make every car electric within the next 6 years. And you start seeing where all this is going. You'll own nothing and you'll love it. So they're not hiding any longer. We see who they are. It's just the psychosis, the cult-like mindset is so entrapping that good people and otherwise living will suddenly believe that, well, I'm a professional, I'm a medical doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm an engineer, I'm an architect, I'm CPA. I've got to live to a standard that is expected of me. Yeah, what standard is that? Can you not live in your old neighborhood? Can you not have the same friends? Well, I've got to have new friends, and I'm not going to, you know, my wife has already become a friend of our child, and now the child's only seeing a psychiatrist 9 days a week and on 27 medications. Jesus, man. The worst parents in American history are the professional class, but they're also the easiest to propagandize. Let me give you another example. How about how easy is this? Did any of you read the book and documentary that I wrote and produced called Death by Medicine? Every single fact in there was produced from Orthodox medicine's own colleges, like the College of Physicians and Surgeons, the College of Neurology, etc. And it showed that the number one cause of death from all causes was medicine. The number one cause of injury, medicine. Was there a single meeting anywhere at any time to say, you know, we've been doing it wrong? We're rewarded for failing, but shouldn't be rewarded for succeeding. Maybe we should start a preventative program. Why don't we be honest about, hold on, what do you mean? Where are you going with this, Gary? You're saying that we should prevent disease? That's stupid. If we prevent disease, then suddenly check off the list. Oh, big pharma, genetically engineered foods, vaccines. Oh, sugar, meat, alcohol, moderation in all things. Oh, I see. So if we really wanted to prevent disease, we would have to challenge many of the people in power and their institutions and their corporations. And they have lobbyists to make sure that doesn't happen. Absolutely right. So don't go there. Well, maybe we should have a different approach to depression and anxiety, since all the scientific literature shows that nothing they're doing is really reversing the condition, making it worse, increasing suicide, etc. Can't do that. Well, didn't you just do something really stupid? Didn't you just make a condition a disease. Oh, yeah, you didn't hear about that? Yeah. So if you're tardy, if you're late, they're now considering lateness to be, you guessed it, a medical mental disorder requiring medication. Yeah, true story. So everywhere you look, they, in control, lie. And why do they want your metrics? Why do they want your fingerprints? Why do they want your... Because then that's the biggest business in America. That's where they're making hundreds of billions of dollars, over $400 billion, sharing your information. So they don't want you to be able to keep any information private. They can control you once they control your information and they know all about you. That's what we're talking about. So they can control the legislators. Shouldn't Glenn Greenwald say, do we really need a military-industrial complex of $887 billion? No, we do not. And how much of that is waste and fraud? About half. So we could get by with $400 billion and put the rest back into cleaning up ghettos and bringing back factories. We could, but we're not going to. Why? Because those industries, controlled by the deep state, controlled by major corporations that own interest in the stock, like BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Berkshire Hathaway, Fidelity, they control policy behind the scenes. So your legislator gets, well, they get reelected. There's only like somewhere around a 16% more or less approval rating for members of Congress, yet 98% get reelected. How's that possible? Because they put money into the hands of legislators to keep them voting the way that they're supposed to vote. So a few have the courage and honesty and integrity to vote against it. Bernie Sanders just happened to be one of them. But the illusion is that the ones who vote against something are undemocratic. So they're the ones who accepted the COVID vaccinations. And why hasn't there been an official committee hearing bringing in all the people involved, the manufacturers, the scientists, the FDA, the CDC, and hold them all accountable and do an investigation on the worst medical scandal in history? Because they've convinced the average person that everything was done right. It was just unforeseen circumstances. So we're not going to show you how many people have died. We're not going to show you all the young athletes have died. We're not going to go there. You begin to understand why this is the information you really should be thinking about, because they already have thought about it. And only because certain countries are pushing back on some of these World Economic Forum and World Health Organization and UN resolutions, do we have any freedom left at all? Guess which country is least likely to challenge authority? You bet, the United States. We'll have more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.